posted on exterior walls of Jack Young Middle School in Baraboo Monday morning.
I will describe them to say that they were anti-Semitic in nature. I would like to not go any further into it because I don't want to do anything that would compromise the police investigation at this point.
The department is investigating both the video and the flyers. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, 10 minutes after 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, let's take a look at WGTD Sports and Weather. The NBA, the Bucks lost to Indiana, 113-97. The Bulls had the night off. Bucks are off tonight. The Bulls play in Orlando. NHL, the Blackhawks beat the Pittsburgh Penguins 6-3. They're off tonight. NFL Thursday Night Football, the LA Chargers take on the Kansas City Chiefs. College basketball, number 16 ranked UW Badgers host Savannah State at the Kohl's Center. Now the WGTD Thursday forecast from the National Weather Service. Some patchy morning fog, that'll burn off. We'll have a partly sunny Thursday, a high of 39. 35 degrees overnight with some light rain. Friday, 43. And then a sunny weekend. Saturday, sunny and 43. Sunday, sunny and 46. Right now, wind is calm. The sun is shining. 28 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Before we get to Thursday's morning show, we want to thank you for the support that you've given to Wisconsin Public Radio with their year-end membership drive. If you would still like information about being a part of the Wisconsin Public Radio family, information is available at their website, wpr.org. Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again. And that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack Andrea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today is our last 2018 visit from Nan Calvert, who has joined us once a month, nearly all year long, to offer up various programs related to the environment. And she is finishing out the year with a bang, with a very, very important topic and a couple of very, very exciting guests. So first of all, Nan Calvert, we welcome you back to the morning show, and we thank you for all the help you've given with the morning show over this year.
Well, thanks. I'm happy to be here, and I love being part of this. So we're very grateful that you give us this venue.
So the topic today is one that I know is near and dear to your hearts, and it's also kind of a complicated topic that is worthy of some serious exploration, namely wetlands. Mm-hmm. What makes them important? What is a wetlands? And what can be done to restore wetlands that in one way or another have been damaged or maybe all but eliminated? And you have brought a couple of very impressive experts on the topic to join us today. Tell us about that.
So, yes, wetlands are increasingly important by the second. They always have been. And I think now that they're, hopefully we're on the cusp of people understanding why they're so important. Essentially, you could call them the kidneys of the earth. So in terms of water storage and water quality and the wide variety of species that depend on wetlands for their survival, We really cannot function without them. And so there are a lot of projects going on in and around Racine and Kenosha counties that have to do with wetlands restoration. And so one of the things that we hope to talk about today is the idea of what is restoration, because sometimes it looks so drastic and it really upsets people, and for good reason, because there's so little understanding about what a restoration project is and what it seeks to accomplish and how you do that. It's not instantaneous. It's done in phases, and the first phase often has to do with removal of all kinds of things that don't belong there. It also has to sometimes do with really heavy earth-moving equipment, and it just seems like, you know, maybe it was better the way it was, but it isn't, I can assure you.
But yeah, it can look pretty ugly in the early stages, at least at a glance, especially if you don't understand what's going on. So
right,
that's part of what you want to talk
about
today.
And when you see a lot of trees coming down, people are thinking, oh my gosh, what the heck is happening over there? Are they building a parking lot? What's going on? But no, so we'll talk about that. And then we're going to highlight at least a couple of different projects, one that's ongoing, and certainly we'll talk about one that's a really shining example of what can happen when a restoration project is done well and you have the long term in mind. So that's what we hope to accomplish today in the minutes that we have.
Right. So introduce to our listeners the two very special guests to join us. One has been with us before.
He has been before. This is Dave Giordano, and he's the executive director of Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network, which is a really groovy organization that does all kinds of things, sometimes seemingly under the radar. And I'll let Dave talk to you about that. And then to my immediate left, the queen of wetlands restoration, as she is known, is Alice Thompson. And she is the owner of Thompson & Associates, who we're very fortunate to have in this region.
And they are engaged in, among other things, wetlands restoration.
Deeply engaged, yes.
Right.
Yes.
And so we will talk about some specific projects in which they are presently engaged. So great to have all three of you on the morning show today. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Appreciate you being here. So maybe ahead of it, to just deepen the introductions just a little bit, first of all, Dave Giordano, say a word about kind of the wide-ranging mission of Root Pike Win.
Yeah, thank you, and we appreciate you having us here today to talk about wetlands and restoration. Our mission at Root Pike Win is to protect, restore, and sustain the Root Pike Basin, which is essentially the bowl in which water flows. The watersheds that we protect are the five watersheds in southeastern Wisconsin that flow into Lake Michigan. All five of those watersheds are impaired for various different, what they call non-point source runoff pollutants, things like sediment, phosphorus, nitrogen, E. coli, chlorides, things like that. So those, when that water runs off, it ultimately pollutes our tributaries, our wells, our rivers, and ultimately Lake Michigan and the beaches. So, you know, we're the only organization in the Racine, Kenosha area in the Lake Michigan watershed area that's solely devoted to restoration projects to restore these watersheds. And, you know, one of the things, you know, I'd always heard about the importance of wetlands, but I never really understood them. You know, my background isn't in ecology or restoration, things like that. But over the last 3 years as the executive director, I've gotten a much better sense of the application of wetlands with regard to stormwater management, with regard to reducing pollutants and flood storage. And if you remember nothing else from our talk here today, it's, you know, I reference a Purdue study that said, you know, an acre of wetland about a foot deep holds over 300,000 gallons of water. In the Pike River watershed alone, 90% of the watershed or the wetlands have been either altered or removed altogether. Hmm. So when we get these rain events that may have been maybe less in terms of impact 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, the amount of impervious pavement, the lack of wetlands is now exacerbating this situation.
Right. So wetlands is one important element in safeguarding the health of the overall watershed. I mean, it's a really important piece of the puzzle, in a sense.
It really is. And, you know, we all love turtles and frogs and things like that that live in these wetlands, but it goes much deeper than that. The pollutant processing power of wetlands and those wetland plants is amazing. It is truly amazing. And that flood storage that I mentioned, that water storage, is amazing. So we're expecting the watershed to do the same thing with, as Nan referenced, with 10% of the kidney function.
Hmm. And there's just not a way for that to happen. So.
Right. So either the municipalities have to build more infrastructure, stormwater infrastructure, or pipe it as quickly as they can off into Lake Michigan. Well, that's great from a volume perspective, but it doesn't solve our pollutant perspective, and it certainly doesn't solve our habitat and our what we call creating places where people want to be.
Right.
And that's near these environmental corridors.
So this is why this wetlands restoration work is so important. That's why people like Alice Thompson, the queen of wetlands, is such a celebrity, at least in this room and among environmentalists in southeastern Wisconsin.
Beyond this room.
Yes,
yeah, right,
far
right.
beyond.
Absolutely. We're really glad to have you here. Alice Thompson, could you explain to us when and why and how you became such a ferocious advocate for wetlands and wetlands restoration? I mean, when did this story begin for you?
Wow. Well, you know, I'm a child I remember the first Earth Day, 1970. So I remember we were at that year. It happened to be in Florida. My family was in Florida that year, and I was pitchforking water hyacinths out of a lake called Lake Alice. So I guess my roots go very long into the past, but then I took a meandering path in life until I got back to going to graduate school at UWM, and I graduated in 1995. Dr. Jim Reinarts was my major professor, and he was a wetland expert. And so I became sort of what was in the back of my mind, an interest, suddenly became a career. So life took me here, and I'm very grateful that life took me here. Yeah.
Very good.
Yeah.
So before we talk about the restoration work that you and your firm and other firms do, mm-hmm. and some of the projects that you are currently involved in, we probably need to clarify I'm thinking for many of our listeners, exactly what a wetland is. And I say that in part because I think most of us have at least a vague notion of what a wetland kind of looks like and what it sort of is, but I think very few people know, like you do, exactly what a wetlands is. So what would you give us as the clearest definition for the average citizen to understand?
Okay, well, wetlands are protected by law, so because of that, there are actually really specific criteria that a wetland has. And as a wetland delineator, I look at wetlands all the time, or uplands, and I determine what is a wetland and what is an upland. And so first of all, you know, we kind of have this notion that something with cattails is a wetland, but and sort of everybody can agree on that. But wetlands can be very dry places many times of the year. These ephemeral ponds that pond in spring and then dry down can be wetlands. Floodplain forests are wetlands that you can walk through many times of the year, and yet in a huge flood, you know, the silver maples over in Wawelusing State Park are suddenly, like, you know, many, many feet high of water. So and then bogs we recognize as wetlands, tamarack cedar, white cedar bogs. So there's this really huge prairie down in Chewaukee Prairie is wetland prairie, you know, these low spongy prairies. So first of all, there's this huge variety of what makes a wetland. But when you look specifically at a wetland, you look at the soils, and the soils have been inundated with water over decades and decades and centuries, and very, you know, since the last glacier receded in many cases. So they've stripped off all the iron, the brown colors, and they're gray or black. So you look at the color of the soil and the texture of the soil that determines that it's been underwater for many, many years. And then you look at the vegetation, and is the vegetation mostly in wetlands or mostly in uplands? And we literally have a book that says how often each plant is in wetlands or uplands, and we check off each plant to see what percent a cattail is 100% of the time in a wetland or 99% or something, and a dandelion is mostly in an upland. So, you know, you sort through these plants, and they're telling you something, like you're reading the landscape and going, okay, these plants are over here and these plants are over here. The wetland line is somewhere in between. And then the other thing we look out for, which is the most elusive thing often, is hydrology. How wet is the site? You know, if you're standing there and you're standing in water, that's pretty easy. But like I said, a lot of times the water is very ephemeral. It comes and goes, and you might happen to pick a day where there is no water. What do you look for?
Mm.
Well, trees that grow in wetlands, if you go out and look at a wetland tree, it's shallow roots. It can't go down. The roots can't go down because there's no oxygen. So they're perched on the surface of the water.
Mm.
They're perched on the soil, spreading out in all directions, trying to keep aloft, you know, trying to keep high, but they can't go deep. So that's one clue that you're in a wetland. The leaves on the ground are blackened and water stained. So you know there was water earlier in the year. You might turn the leaf over and find a tiny little snail or a little aquatic clam under the leaf. You're going to look at the lines of the trees where you can see that water ponds different times a year. So all these chimney crayfish, those lovely, if you come upon a wetland and there's a stacked up muddy chimney inside, like about 4 or 5 inches off the ground, there's this little chimney made out of clay. Inside is a deep into the ground is a crayfish, and it's living in this hole, and they go down to the water table, and so they're another indication that there's water and close to the surface. So you look at all these like very subtle indicators. So when you decide it's a wetland, it's got wetland soils, it's got wetland vegetation, and it has evidence of hydrology. That, you know, it only has to be, you know, I think it's like it kind of changes the definition, the official definition changes, but it's something like, you know, 12 days out of the year, there's water within 12 inches of the soil surface, something like that. I don't know if I have it exact at the moment, but at any rate, it doesn't require a lot of water to make a wetland plants and soil and to function as Nan is saying, as a kidney. You know, it doesn't take having a lot of water to make a big impact.
Interesting. It's probably hard to summarize this, but generally speaking, how large are wetlands? I mean, how large can a wetlands be?
That's right.
And how small can a wetlands be? I mean, can somebody have wetlands just in their own backyard? Can they be that small?
Well, we have no sort of size discrimination almost about what you know. If you're a tiny little frog, it doesn't take a lot to make a wetland home for you, as long as you've got standing water and some vegetation to hang out on. So wetlands can be acres and acres and acres. I think the Cedarburg bog is maybe 5 miles wide by 1 mile long, something like that. I mean, they can be really huge. Basin Horicon Marsh is an example of like a really massive wetland system, and yet a acre wetland, a half acre, a quarter acre, all of these provide important, not as many functions, but some functions. And that's the thing we recognize too, is not every wetland does every piece of the functions of what we think of as important.
Right.
So
for instance, in southeastern Wisconsin, do you know where all the wetlands are? I mean, like, could you take out a map of these two counties, Racine and Kenosha, and tell us, I mean, have you just through your own professional work had to determine that, where all the wetlands are, or in a sense, are there still wetlands or, I would assume, very small little patches of wetland that, in a sense, are still to be discovered or still to be delineated?
Yeah, the major wetlands, like you're saying, are you're right. We know where Shawaki Prairie is. We know where Horicon Marsh is. We know where, you know, various large systems are. The Wisconsin DNR has a mapping system of the whole state, and they've laid on it from aerial photography where they think wetlands are. So there's blotches which are suspected wetlands, and then there's soils that have potential wetland to them. So no, we don't know where all the wetlands are, and that's part of my job, is if someone's developing a property or selling a property or doing something, I come out, I look at the maps, and then I come out and determine exactly where the wetlands are. And that changes over time too. It's not a constant. You change a culvert on one side of the road, or you put a road up somewhere else, and then all of a sudden the water shifts around, and the wetland boundary can kind of creep in other ways. Mm.
So
it's
delineate,
not even a constant.
Right. So a delineator's work is never done.
Right. Okay. Exactly. Exactly.
Interesting. And I think you've said this point already, but we probably should underscore the fact that you are a delineator, and you do delineation not just for the heck of it or for the fun of it, but because there is an important reason.
Yes.
To know exactly where a wetland is and,
yes,
to some extent at least, what its boundaries are. And explain why this delineation process is so useful and also necessary under law.
Right. Well, as like maybe something like 80% of wetlands are on private land. They're not all state and federally owned at all. Like the majority are on private properties. So if we want to protect wetlands, we have to be protecting them across the board on state and federal and public and private land. And that's why they are protected, because they are so important to all of our health. And with I want to just throw in there, with climate change, sort of thrust upon us, they only become more important as time goes on. And so the job I do helps a property owner, because what you don't want to have happen is ignore where the wetland boundary is, throw up your pole barn, throw up your addition, put a road through, and then find out you violated law. Mm. That's a very uncomfortable place for someone to be in. So by knowing up front where the wetlands are, you can plan accordingly. You can get permits. It doesn't mean you can't do your project, but you might need to get a permit to put a road crossing in, or you might have to get a permit to do something, modification. So you're doing it legally, which is really important.
Right.
And then you're doing it in an environmentally sustainable way. So you're treating the land as, this is a value, and how can I work my project around it?
Right.
Yeah, and if I could just add to that, one of the things that Rude Pike Wind does is we work with everybody, and we try to find the win-win situations. Often with these developments, the constraints of a wetland could constrain the development, right? Mm-hmm. Well, we try to work with them, with developers and municipalities, to figure out how we can maximize the restoration of that particular wetland on that site, or try to get it as close to the impact as possible. And it's a delicate dance, and we serve kind of an important role in that. We try to be the arbitrator of what really makes the most sense for the watershed. And more we're seeing corporate entities want to come back, and they're part of a social responsibility program. They want to do the right thing. They just, in a lot of cases, they just don't know what the right thing is to do. Mm. And again, that's where we serve a valuable role as well.
Absolutely. For those of you just joining us, we're talking about wetlands and wetlands restoration. First of all, with Nan Calvert, who has helped create this program today. Dave Giordano is executive director of Rude Pike Wind, that helps to safeguard the watershed here in Racine and Kenosha counties. And we have Alice Thompson with us of Thompson & Associates, and this is a firm that engages in the important work of wetlands restoration. And we're going to be talking in just a moment about several different projects that are happening right here in this corner of the state involving wetlands restoration. Ahead of that, I wanted for you to offer up some clarification on two terms that look really close. And on your firm's beautiful website, there's some information given about wetlands restoration versus something else called mitigation.
Yeah.
So let's talk first about what mitigation means. It is not the same thing, but it's another important facet of what your firm does.
Right. So wetland mitigation is a program where if you have a permit to fill a wetland and you've gone over 10,000 square feet of wetland fill, you need to mitigate. It's called sort of mitigate the fill in by creating wetland and restoring wetland in another place that restores the function of what's lost. And so a wetland mitigation project would be doing restoration, but it would be doing it in a very specific legal context to cover fill of a project that had to do a certain wetland fill.
Right. And
then
and can I just stop you for a second?
Yeah.
So when you talk about wetland fill.
Yeah.
So are we talking about where there's this patch of wetlands and somebody wants to build something on it, and so you have to bring something in because you couldn't build something on a wetlands, not because I'm not talking about the legality of it, but just the laws of physics that you just can't build a Burger King on wetlands because it would sink from sight, I suppose. So so people would bring in
soil,
something.
I mean, you're bringing in soil and rock, and you're building the ground up, and you're covering over what was a wetland with now buildable soil. And that's the issue: is a wetland always buildable? Not always. Mm. So that's
right.
a concern as well. But yes, so then that would be mitigated somewhere else. The fill in one place would be mitigated somewhere else.
So that, and in a sense, creating new wetlands where they did not exist.
Yeah. Although, as scientists, we try not to go to a creation where you're going to upland and creating this wetland. They don't tend to work as well. What we do is go to a site that was wetland. It was possibly drained for farming and has drain tiles and ditches. And then by restoring that back, you have probably a better chance of getting some of these wetland values back. So we tend to go to something called restoration, even within the context of mitigation, because wetland creation, where you go out in the backyard and just start digging a hole, may not be very successful.
Right.
So you want to hopefully start with those historic soils at least.
Right. And so, for instance, mitigation is involved in something like, for instance, this massive Foxconn development, that one of the things that is a stipulation is mitigation of wetlands, and actually I understand by a higher percentage than normal, actually. I mean,
like
for every acre they're destroying of wetland, the mitigation is, I think, two times that, I think, is the way that
they would need to they have to restore as part of the program for every acre that they take out or cap or cover impact. They would need to then find a spot somewhere else in the watershed, preferably as close to the project or even within another part of the project as possible. So that's where I think the regulation becomes really important, where it's not just in the past, you used to be able to buy those credits. It's a kind of a credit system. You'd be able to buy those credits in another part of the state. So while our watershed is losing wetland at a rapid pace, you know, it used to be where they could buy those credits, those mitigation credits, from somewhere maybe up in Hayward. They changed those rules in a positive way. It's much smarter now, where they're under a lot of constraints to mitigate those impacts as close to that site as possible.
So our watershed isn't unduly damaged by the loss of wetlands.
Right, and if you think about it, you know, in the case of Foxconn, most of the wetlands that they're impacting, some of them are wetlands that people, you drive by and you're like, oh yeah, okay, that looks like a wetland. But a lot of it is in farmland that's been tilled for decades and decades and decades. So, you know, in some of those cases, those wetlands, if that continued to be farmed, they wouldn't necessarily come back or be restored. But as part of this development, the kind of the ironic upside is that now within the watershed, you know, we're gonna see more wetland restoration happen, and the really, and it's almost weird for me to say it, is the development becomes almost the catalyst to see more of that mitigation happen.
Right,
and that's the cooperative between the DNR, the Army Corps of Engineers, the EPA. I mean, that's all highly regulated. It's a really detailed recipe that they have to follow. Hmm. They can't get around those particular requirements.
Right.
And that's an upside for the watershed.
Yeah, interesting and ironic, as you said. So, Alice Thompson, let's talk about then this business of restoration in a little more detail. When we use the term restoration, it sure sounds like something that used to be a wetlands or used to be a wonderful wetlands that now maybe is a less healthy wetlands or something or other. I mean, explain why this term restoration is so appropriate for so much of the work that you do.
Yeah, thank you. So, the idea is many wetlands were impacted by agriculture, by deliberately drain tiles were put in, ditches were dug, they were drained. Other wetlands are downstream of agriculture, and so New Miller Woods, that's our specific site we're in the process of restoring right now, received up to 2 feet of sediment from other farm fields. So a lot of wetlands, because they're in low places, get loaded with sediment beyond sort of their ability to handle it. So what you do when you restore a wetland is you come in and look at the impacts. What has happened to this wetland, or what has happened to this farmed former wetland? What are all the impacts, and then how can I undo those impacts one by one to restore it?
And when a wetlands has been damaged, what does that look like? I mean, for instance, is it less wet, or is what is growing there different? I mean, or is it smaller than it used to be? I mean,
More shallow? Very good. All of those. That's excellent. Yeah, no, absolutely. Because the water's been drained off it, it's often very dry, and maybe it even barely makes it as a wetland, but it's way beyond. It's sort of like the patient on the on the gurney getting hauled into the emergency room. It's a shade of its former self. So it's much drier. It's smaller. Exactly, as it dries, it smalls. And then the vegetation. I mean, right now we're growing cabbage on former wetlands, or we're growing or if it's been let go, it's just got kind of weedy wetland indicators that aren't particularly native plants. So when we think about restoration, we want to bring the water back, we want to re-wet the soils, and we want to try to bring as much possible the native species back. But not only the plant species, but all the suite of wading birds and migratory birds and frogs and turtles and all these, be great if we had a spot for beaver to be active on. We want to bring all these animals back, and these pollinators. We're losing pollinators rapidly. Wetlands flowers and native flowers provide pollinator habitat. So there's so many suites of things we try to bring back. But let's just be real too. We're in a watershed with a lot of invasive species. So part of bringing a wetland back is constant management, because invasive species are out there. They like to come in wherever we start making disturbances, and they can be a real challenge in our watershed.
I'd like to give a shout out to Barney Lavin. Excuse me, I have an amphibian in my throat, which is appropriate for this discussion. So Barney Lavin is a farmer in the town of Dover. His family has farmed there for, since the 1800s. And he took it upon himself to restore, and I don't remember how many acres, it's very, very large, restore wetland that had been drained, filled for farming. Mm-hmm. And it really was not particularly optimal, because it always wants to be a wetland again. And he thought, I can try and continue, experiencing frustration, or I can let this be what it used to be. And it is absolutely fantastic. The aquatic bird life is amazing. And anyone from Hoy Audubon can tell you about that, because they take field trips to it every single year. And I'm lucky to live only about a mile from it. So, these projects can be phenomenally successful when you have the right people in place and you have landowners who understand that, yes, perhaps I'm losing some acres of corn or beans, but in the long run, over time, this is far more beneficial.
And, one of the other incredible upsides with a project like New Miller Woods and the North Branch of the Pike River is they become catalysts for what we call environmental corridors. Okay, so New Miller is going to be a keystone for what is called the Summers Branch of the Pike River. Okay, so that inspires more corridor work, and you bring more species together. But you along the corridor, it becomes truly green infrastructure, where the whole corridor does the pollutant processing, it does the flood storage, it does the groundwater infiltration, and then that becomes the model for other tributaries in the watershed and beyond. And that is exactly what has happened with the North Branch of the Pike River. That project has been incredibly successful, not just in what it does, but what it's inspired for other municipalities and other parts of our watershed. Mm.
So, Alice Thompson, let's get grimy and dirty here now and talk about kind of what the physical work is in restoring a wetlands. I mean, exactly what has to happen and how do you make that happen?
Well, let's talk about a couple of examples because it's so different on each site. So for New Miller Woods, it's a little 8-acre wooded wetland with some uplands surrounding it. And what we found when we came and got dirty and dug holes was it had like this 2 feet of sediment in it. So we designed this, and the stream had been straightened. So many of the streams alongside wetlands have been straightened in size for agricultural and other uses. So they're not even connected with this floodplain in many cases. So what we designed is sort of a surgical remedy to a part of this woods. We don't want to take the woods out. They're beautiful, and they're already providing habitat. There are some dying green ash, unfortunately, because of emerald ash borer. But we're going to come in and make a scrape, a wetland scrape, just like a 2-foot little basin with rounded edges, and the water's going to be encouraged to, instead of going straight, it's going to kind of meander into this basin and then back out again. So we're kind of increasing the amount of time maybe water will spend there, hopefully attracting a little more amphibian use. And so that's a sort of special sort of what I call sort of surgical. Like we want to be super careful because we've already got something nice.
Hmm.
Another example is Hawthorne Hollow, which is a nature center on Highway 31, where we have a wetland that was drained. Then the pond was dug in the 60s. And now there's still an old drain tile that's taking water into a ravine, and the ravine is eroding into the Pike River.
Mm.
So what we want to do is back water up, restore it there by taking that drain tile out, digging out some lower ground in an area that's not wetland but has pretty deep soils, or where we think we can get a little wetland establishment there, and take some of the pressure off that ravine and back the water up and get it to behave more like a wetland and not just this pipe down, eroding down into the ravine. So that's another example of what we're doing. And then the Pike River, as Dave mentioned, I've been involved with since 2002 for the Village of Mount Pleasant. And in that case, there were 100 houses being routinely flooded because the stream was so incised and so deep that the floodplain no longer existed. It was like stream houses, you know.
Wow.
There was no floodplain left. So we couldn't bring the stream back up to the old floodplain, so we dropped the floodplain down. So we cut out huge quantities of soil and hauled them off and made big piles of soil somewhere else. Hills of soil will be some kid's snowy sledding spot
hill
someday. So we created these really broad, broad stream shelves that the water could then flow out into and absorb the flood. And we created prairie and wetlands and ponds all along this 5.5-mile corridor. A trail is going to be going in. You'll be able to go from Old Spring Street all the way to Petrifying Springs once the trail system is completed. So it's
wow.
A huge amenity to the public. Sora Rail immediately moved in. We saw somebody saw a hooping crane stop by a spot there last spring. We have routinely birds and animals just flooding into it. The other thing was all these obstructions were taken out of the river so that fish passage could happen. So this is an example of real cooperation, and the people along it benefited. We were out there helping, doing some invasive species control, and the neighbor said, I never flood anymore, and I used to flood all the time.
Hmm.
So there was a real impact to people and a real impact to the environment. So it's a real success, and I'm really happy to have Dave say this is an example of what can continue elsewhere because it's been a really important project.
Yeah, and I would just add to that, you know, the other things that Root Pike Wind does is we engage a lot with the municipalities, and we do that through our 9 key element Pike River plan. That was the first EPA plan to ever be approved in the state of Wisconsin. And that plan is kind of like a voluntary diet for the watershed, where the nutrients, there's too much nutrient loading into the into our river and into Lake Michigan. So this is kind of the, hey, this is what you should do to, you know, lose your nutrient weight. So we take that plan out, and every day we're trying to advance projects. New Miller Woods is one of those areas. It's critical. One of the success stories here also is that now that municipalities have become more familiar with it, and they see the multiple benefits from these kinds of projects, specifically wetlands, and they understand the flood storage, they understand the pollutant processing, they've become much more willing partners. Kenosha County has been a fantastic partner. The Village of Summers, they have entertained a lot of different ideas from us. They ask a lot of great questions, and they've been, you know, really willing partners lately too. So I think that's been – that ultimately benefits our community. So it's not just about water, but when you have clean water, you have places where people want to be. And when you have places where people want to be, they want to invest there, they want to live there, they want to play there, they want to raise their kids there, and that's good for everybody.
And they want to pay taxes there.
Right. But it becomes,
or they do pay taxes. They don't want to, but they will.
That's an important point.
Yeah.
Yeah. It becomes important to them. They build a relationship with it, which is what I talk about a lot of times.
Absolutely.
I just want to mention a couple of things that Alice has said. So she's talking about rechannelizing streams in many instances. Instead of them being long and straight and narrow, which increases velocity and volume, you want them to be meandering so that you can slow the water down, it can handle the volume, and you reduce erosion. Mm-hmm. Streams aren't supposed to be these straight lines like many of our roads are. The other thing I want to say is people get nervous when they hear people talking about, we're going to back up the water so it will stay there a little while. Mm-hmm. Because people always associate wetlands with mosquitoes. And yes, mosquitoes are an aquatic insect. But the thing is, if you have a healthy, functioning, diverse wetland system, mosquitoes don't become the problem because there are so many things that predate them, so many things that eat the larva, so many things that eat the mature insect. So really, it's highly degraded wetlands and other examples of standing water that we create that increase the difficulty with mosquitoes.
Good point.
So don't be worried. If
you've been in my backyard, I've
yes,
seen
I have.
So Alice Thompson, does your firm own the bulldozers and dump trucks and stuff, or are you contracting others to bring in that equipment and actually kind of do the muscle work? And what is your personal role when this restoration work is being done? I mean, are you out there standing in the bog, making sure people aren't doing what they shouldn't be doing?
Yeah, that's one part of it, exactly. So my role would be to first come in and come up with a plan. I might be working with an engineer to create the engineered plans. I'm not an engineer, so I might pull in a hydrologist or an engineer to help with that. And then I'm assisting with getting permits oftentimes, because this work does involve permits. I'm assisting with funding. And so let's just say for a minute, you need money to do this. For private landowners, as Nan suggested, Barry Levensite, there are federal programs from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife and the Natural Resource Conservation Service that will actually help pay for these projects. And then if they agree that they'll, you know, keep it in place for so many years, they have to sign some kind of easements. They can have a lot of that done by the federal agencies that are trying to get more water fowl habitat and so forth out there. So that's first thing. Then we have to look for funding. So the funders for the project New Miller Woods, this Root Pike Watershed Initiative, started it off. Fund for Lake Michigan is a huge funder of the project, and the Wisconsin DNR and the Village of Summers. So finding funding is, so sometimes I'm writing grants and so forth. And then you're right, I don't do the bulldozing work, but when the bulldozers and the backhoe gets out there, I'm on the site making sure that it's being done appropriately. And that's really important. And then once it's finished, we're out, and there's always like tweaks to the plan, right? No, nothing ever goes it to plan. You're like, oh, this is happening. Okay, well, now let's do this. You know, so there's a little bit of that going on. And then there's maintenance and monitoring over time, getting I've seeded wetlands, I've planted trees, and then I've looked at them decades to see if they're doing well and need some herbiciding of Phragmites, or something's happened. There's some erosion happening here. We got to do something here. So there's maintenance over time, and I do those parts also.
Wow.
But I'm not on the backhoe.
But it's probably important to say that you know, because at a glance, this doesn't look like what in fact it is. It doesn't necessarily look like restoration. It looks like destruction.
Yes, yes.
And you have to make sure that those dump trucks or bulldozers are doing exactly what they are supposed to be doing.
That's very true.
Wow.
And sometimes it's so funny when you're working with an operator who's been doing, let's say, houses, and they want to make everything smooth and flat to put in a house. And I'm like, I want it rough. And they're like, rough? Like I have to get in there. No, I don't want it smooth. They're smoothing it out, making it all pretty. I'm like, no, rough it up. So this one operator took me about 2 days, and finally he's like, you want me to puff it up? I'm like, yeah, puff it up. So he's like using his backhoe, scraping it and puffing it up for me. You know,
so
like we finally found the word where it was like, yes, that's what I want.
Right.
And they're looking at me like, you sure you want this? Hey, you know, this looks great. So because nature is not a smooth, flat place, and you need highs and lows, and plants and are going to when you throw seed mix down, the high points are going to get a certain seed going and the low points are going to get another seed going. And you want that, what we call micro topography, little changes. And the rougher it is, the better. So those are some of the things I have to work with.
So you have these big, tough bulldozer guys who want to smooth everything out. And Alice Thompson comes along and says, nope, rough it up. Okay. I like that picture a lot. So, Alice, can you give people the address for Thompson Associates website? And I was serious before. It really is a wonderful website, just full of wonderful information and lots of photos.
Thank you. And you know, I work out of my basement, so I felt like the website is sort of my business. You know, I don't have an office frontage, so it's kind of my office frontage. And I'm really glad you enjoy it. And it's www.thompsonwetlands, so thompsonwetlands.com. And if you just write in Alice Thompson, Wisconsin, it'll pop up also, so you'll find it. Yeah,
well, this has been great, great fun and really fascinating. So we commend you for all the great work that you do on this important issue, and I'm so glad you made time in your schedule to be part of the morning show today.
Thank you. It's been a very
really
enjoyable
great to talk
being
to you.
With Dave and Nan.
Yeah, and Dave Giordano from Root Pike Wind. Always great to catch up with you. Thank you for being part of the morning show as well.
Thank you, Greg. Yeah. It's been a pleasure.
Nan, you have a calendar of events to go through quickly here?
Yes, quickly. Pringle Nature Center, Friday, December 14th from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. Go there because you're going to be viewing the Geminid meteor shower, one of the absolute best meteor showers of the year. They're going to do an informal talk about the night skies, and you're going to have hot cocoa before you go outside and see the show. You do have to register, $3 for Friends of Pringle and $5 for people who have yet to become Friends of Pringle Nature Center. Racine Dominican Eco Justice Center. You know, the winter solstice is coming up. That'll be on December 21st. From 6 till 7:30, you'll be able to enjoy a celebration of the winter solstice with reflection and music. There's going to be a lovely exchange of appetizers, and the event is free. These things are always really fun at the Eco J. And last but certainly not least, Riverbend Nature Center. They'll be having a winter break nature camp December 26th through December 28th. Your kids can come one day or all 3 days. The kids will spend time around the campfire, track winter wildlife, and explore the winter landscape of River Bend. $30 per day for members, $35 for non-members. Camp runs from 9 until 2 p.m.
Very good.
And just quickly, now is, you know, the time we think of as the giving time. It's a really great time to support your local nature centers and, you know, give a gift that will keep on giving long after it's been received, and other places such as Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network and all kinds of wonderful things.
Great idea. Great thought. And Nan Covert, thank you for all the assistance you've given to the morning show over this past year. Look forward to 2019 very much.
Oh, so am I. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you so much. Tomorrow on the morning show, Bob Glauber, an award-winning sports journalist and the author of a terrific new book called Guts and Genius, which looks back at three NFL head coaches in the 1980s who dominated the NFL in some really, really spectacular ways. That will be tomorrow's morning show. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, WGTD.org. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. We're approaching 9 o'clock.